Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Jason Snell.
John, it's great to be back, and great to read more things from my youth.
This time we are reading a genuine high school book.
Yeah.
I'll admit something right now. I've never actually read the novel version of Flowers for Algernon all the way through. I started it several times. I put it down.
Me neither. I never even tried it. I don't think I've ever read this book. I only read the short story. All of my memories are from the short story, which this book is an expansion of. This is also apparently a banned book. So that's exciting that in a lot of places people tried to ban this book from schools. It's always good to get a banned book.
I was a little bit shocked with some of the content in this. I remember the short story as being very inoffensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this time we are doing Daniel Key's Flowers for Algernon, which most people will know from its, 1966 version as a novel? What was the year that it was a novel?
Yes, 66 as a novel. Short story was in 1959 in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. It won the Hugo Award for Best Short Story. Very famous in science fiction circles, short story, but it got turned into a novel and, of course, a film where Cliff Robertson won the Oscar for Best Actor, I believe, for playing Charlie in Charlie, which was the adaptation of Flowers for Algernon.
Right, which is a terrible, terrible thing to change the title to Flowers for Algernon, because I think Flowers for Algernon is one of the great titles in literature.
Oh, yeah. Agree completely.
Yeah. So what is your history with the story, if not with a novel?
Well, so the story... I first was exposed to it at some point in elementary school or high school, and as a science fiction fan, I always was really impressed. And it also has a sort of legendary nature, I think, not only in the science fiction world, but also as a breakout kind of legendary American short story. I really do believe that this is one of those stories that people who don't know anything or care anything about science fiction writing have been exposed to. I mean, I could argue that it's maybe one of the great American short stories of the 20th century, and a lot of people know about it. So I'd say it's legendary. And also, it made an indelible impression with me. The short story did, like, and you could see the imprint it's left on popular culture, because you can't like every comedy and animated series, and like there are so many references to Flowers for Algernon in pop culture, so it definitely just made an impact. And I remember the emotional impact and the whole idea of, first off, it's very clever that it's a you know, the simple version is, oh, it's a dumb guy and he gets really smart and then he gets really dumb again and it's sad, but the emotional impact, especially about the mouse, which in a very very economical short story, there's a huge emotional impact, not only from the journey that Charlie takes, but the fact that he has this sort of bond with Algernon, and that's the poor mouse that doesn't really know what's happening to it, and you know that that's the path that Charlie is going down too. I really remember being emotionally affected by that, reading the original short story.
The original short story is one of those highly anthologized stories. There was I'm going to date myself here. There was a very influential collection that was published in like 1970 called the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. There was a time where every library in America had a copy of this book, and every used bookstore in America had copies of it. Still a good thing to pick up if you want to pick up an anthology of science fiction stories pre 1970. Like, it starts like with a Martian Chronicle,
right,
by Stanley G. Weinbaum, and then it goes down, and I think Flowers for Algernon is one of the more recent ones in that collection, and that's where I read that, along with It's a Good Life. I read it first in that collection. So So I do recommend finding it. You can find copies of that for not too much out there used. So it won the Hugo. I think it won the Hugo fairly shortly after Hugos were a thing. Maybe like the yeah. third or fourth year that their Hugos were. And as you say, it's popular among people who don't really read science fiction. It's one of those stories that I think people who don't read science fiction would not read as science fiction, you know? Yep. Similarly with like White Noise, you know, White Noise in some ways is a novel, a science fiction novel. But I think that in literary circles, you know, people who kind of turn up their nose at science fiction would not think of it as primarily a science fiction a novel. Or for some reason, Kurt Vonnegut, who we've read a lot of together, often doesn't get lumped in with science fiction, although he absolutely wrote a lot of science fiction.
Yeah, it's a neat trick to escape the genre, you know, convention. And I don't know what does it. I mean, there's this definitely a lot of people turning up their nose at the genre, but I think probably there's some truth in the fact that there's some parts of the genre that have more literary aspirations than others do, or it's plausible deniability is the other way to look at it, which is, well, you know, it doesn't have aliens or spaceships in it so much. It has fantastical things, but it's a more of a magic realism than science fiction, right? You hear stuff like that, and that's fine. Like Flowers for Algernon has some science in it, you know, but you could also just read it as kind of a fantastical thing, because I think a lot of people misunderstand what science fiction is, and they think that science fiction is about technology and about, you know, computers and spaceships and stuff like that. And good science fiction isn't, it's like all other good literature, it's about society, or it's about people and characters and feelings and the human condition and all those things. And I do think that sometimes Kurt Vonnegut and his ilk, they escape the genre a little bit, because there's enough plausible deniability that somebody can say, well, yes, there are fantastical things in it, but it's not essentially Star Wars. It's not the day the earth stood still. It's about, you know, it's about a poor man in Dresden who's being firebombed. It's like, yeah, but it's also about aliens who are scattered across time. It's like, no, let's not talk about that. It's I don't entirely understand how you get to be out of the genre when you're clearly in the genre, but it happens. And I definitely think it happened with Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah, well, I think you could probably point to any genre and you would find a romance that's not a romance.
Oh,
and
sure.
Find a detective story that's not a detective story. But going back to Flowers for Algernon, I'm not the biggest historian of science fiction, but I have been reading recently the Library of America published a two-volume work of American science fiction novels from the 1950s. It's a really interesting book to read, because these are books that I think have been long out of print, but they're by people that you know, like, you know, Heinlein and Bova and people like that. And when you read those old 50s science fiction stuff, you get this sense of like the there's still writing about characters who are sort of frontiersmen in space. They're all very competent. They're all kind of living these fantastical lives that are sort of like James Bond, but on Mars, where they are caught up in ridiculous space opera-y intrigue, and the characters aren't particularly what you would consider to be realistically drawn. They're sharply drawn, but they're not realistically drawn. This was a novel, or a short story, and then a novel that really attempts to get into the character's head in a kind of a stream of consciousness way. I think the weird thing is I was more on board, I think, for the story than I was for the novel, and we'll get into reasons why. You know, it may be I'm looking through it through the nostalgia glasses of having read this as a child. But I kind of bought Charlie more in the short story than I do in the novel. What were your feelings about Charlie? Did he seem like basically the same character in the novel as the short story?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of worked for me because I think, look, the short story is brilliant. And one of the ways that any short story is brilliant usually is that it's the compression, the fact that you don't have time to go into great detail. And so you, things get waved away, or you make a brief aside about something and move on, and that has to fill in the gap. And there's a real art to it. And I used to, in college, and just after I edited a fiction magazine and on the internet, it's still there, the old issues. And one of over the years, I had a bunch of people who would read the stories with me that came over the transom. And we ended up with a rule that was short stories must be spectacular, because there's no room for, like, they have to be, strangely enough, you have more latitude to be okay in something longer, but a short story really has to nail it. And I think that's one of the things about Flowers for Algernon, the short story, is that it is painting all the brush strokes it needs to create the whole painting, even though so much is implied. It makes just the right moves. And the novel, I really like the novel. I thought it was very good. Like, I was shocked at how much I liked it. And part of the reason I was shocked is, I think in large part, when you have to fill in all those gaps, it's never going to be at the level that the short story was, right? It's so heightened. It is so focused on the most important parts that it's very hard to imagine how expanding it out. I've read other short stories that turned into novels, and you usually end up with kind of a letdown because in the end, it was better off as a short story. And honestly, I didn't feel that about Flowers for Algernon. As great as that short story is, I thought the novel was pretty good at addressing some of the stuff that's really skipped over or doesn't make much sense in the short story, and while still remaining true to it. I think the only major change that happens in the novel versus the short story is that I think Charlie works in a factory in the short story, and in the novel he works at a bakery. And it's just a little bit, it sort of makes more sense in what happens. But, like, the emotional beats are pretty similar. It expands on a lot of the ideas. I feel like it's one of the better examples I've got of a story being inflated to such a degree while retaining its shape. And, you know, I feel like I understand where Charlie's coming from. I think there's a challenge with Charlie's language, right? So one of the things we haven't mentioned yet is that, of course, this is all letters and notes being written by Charlie. And so it starts out with him basically being unable to spell or punctuate or anything. And in a short story, you know, his ramp up to being able to be readable is a lot faster than it is in the book. And that's a little bit rough, because there's a lot of time where you're reading kind of not lucid things that are happening. But I don't know, I really did like it, and I do think that Charlie feels like, I mean, I was gonna say a real person, but like a real person who's put on an accelerated brain chemistry program. Like, that's not actually a real person, but I feel like his emotional journey still worked, even though we got to see a lot more of the details and seeing him fall in love and kind of rejecting that, and, you know, it's a difficult relationship to have with somebody who's artificially intelligent and won't be there for very long, right? Like, that's a tough... I think there's a lot of good stuff that gets added in the novel about how we react to disabled people, intellectually disabled people, how we react to different people, how we react to people who are smarter or not as smart as we are, and, like, what attracts two people together, because you definitely get the sense in the book that, you know, he feels like he's too dumb for her, and then he feels like he's too smart for her, and she feels like she's too dumb for him. And even though these two people are really attracted to each other and kind of in love with each other, they feel like at no point do they feel comfortable until the very end with their position regarding one another. I just, you know, there's a lot of richness to it that worked for me, expanding it out. I can totally see if what the inflation doesn't match your mental image of the story, how it might not work. But I ate it up, honestly. I really did.
Well, I have a kind of a strange issue with this book. And I assume people listening to this are fairly familiar with the basic premise, which is Charlie, a developmentally disabled man, is chosen to have an unexplained operation that will cause him to become very smart. This operation has already been proven to increase the intelligence of a lab mouse named Algernon. Charlie does indeed become very, very smart. Smart enough that he becomes a scholar of his own situation, just as it becomes clear that his intelligence is going to fade because Algernon has already started to fade and become erratic and eventually dies. And Charlie is faced with the fact that he too is going to lose his intelligence and probably die. And so there's this shape of going from a man who can hardly write at all to a man who's highly loquacious and ends up back where we began. In the story, it focuses mostly upon Charlie's intellectual development. And in the book, I think Keyes does an interesting thing, which I mostly agree with, which is he's interested in the idea that this man whose intellect is suddenly developing by decades in the course of a couple of weeks, that change in intellect is doing nothing for his emotional intelligence and for his ability to relate to other people socially. And that's all lagging way behind. And so Charlie has to confront that. And Charlie's relationships with other people are greatly expanded upon. In the story, he did have a relationship with his former teacher,
right,
Alice Kinnean. Ethically problematic, mm-hmm. but in the story, that's the main relationship. In the novel, he also has a secondary story after he's absconded with Algernon, and he becomes involved with this bohemian New Yorker.
She's like a beatnik or something.
This free love woman, mm-hmm. who lives across the hall from him, and you get that relationship too. And eventually the two, Alice and Faye, actually meet each other, and mm-hmm. that's something else. Charlie has suddenly memories fled back to him of memories that he didn't have before, of being a child and of his family situation.
Right.
And this is where the book kind of loses me, because this is a book that was written in the 60s, and Keyes did study psychology, but he studied psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis was psychology in the 60s. And so the premise is all of our personality problems, all of our behavioral problems can be traced back to moments in which we have become stuck or arrested in our sexual development because of these traumatic events in childhood. And so much of this book and the way that Charlie views the world is through this lens of sexual trauma,
mm-hmm.
in a way that I don't believe in Freudianism, so it's a little bit hard for me to see it like being used as such a driver of the plot line for Charlie.
I see that, because if you take it literally, it is a Freudian thing that's going on here. I feel like I was okay with it because it's dressed up in the science fictional baggage of a man who was unable to process his life, and now he's intelligent enough that he can go, he's actually going back through these memories, accessing them and processing them as an adult, but also as a genius, essentially. And that it is kind of a magical bit of self-analysis, right? Because he becomes so intelligent and he doesn't ever become truly emotionally intelligent, which I think is an interesting dichotomy, right? Like the emotional development versus his intellectual development. But you're right. It was not my favorite. Like, I was okay with him, like, meeting his father, who doesn't recognize him, at the barbershop, and meeting his mother, who is actually herself now, kind of unable to take care of herself, and her sister, his sister, who is with her. I thought that I liked those scenes as they were, but yeah, there is this whole thing that's underplaying it. That's like his flashbacks to, he was accused of making sexual moves against his sister, and he had to be sent away because he was this intellectually disabled kid, phenylketonuria, which is, they test every baby for now, but they didn't back then. And so, yeah, I see what you're saying about that. That's not the stuff. The stuff I really like is the stuff where, he can't, you know, he's trying to process, like, what does it say? Like, there's the scene with a busboy where basically there's a intellectually disabled busboy, and everybody's laughing at him, and Charlie laughs at him. And then Charlie is horrified because he's laughing at who he used to be. And he didn't even realize that he was the butt of the jokes until he got more intelligent. And I like stuff like that, where or questioning the scientists and like who's taking credit and are they really giving him the credit for it? And that he ends up having to disprove their theories about himself and prove that he's not going to make it. Or the Algernon storyline. Like, there are a bunch of rich things in here that I really kind of appreciated being expanded upon, but I will totally grant you the fact that his self-analysis of his childhood is by far the least interesting thing in this book.
Well, I mentioned, for example, that Charlie has a relationship with his former teacher, the teacher who taught him at the school for disabled kids, which in this book they use the R word,
yes,
which is, you know,
you gotta, yeah. I was describing the plot to my wife, and she said, you really can't use that word on the podcast. And I said, yeah, but that's what, like, in the book, I mean, that's what we called, even not the like insulting version of it, but the kind of more clinical version of it that is also not used now. But yes, that she's teaching him at the, again, intellectually disabled is my understanding is the right word to use here.
And she is instrumental in suggesting him that he be used with these two professors.
Right.
What are they? Their name Strauss and Niemer, Professor Niemer and Dr. Strauss. And one of the things that is interesting to me about this is a look into mid-century psychological experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
In the original story, what possible kind of surgery would have any effect upon, at least a positive effect on your mental acuity. In this, they kind of expand on this idea that they're removing damaged tissue that has been left by the PKU, and they're somehow stimulating the growth of new neurons that have been grafted in. You know, it's all hand wavy. It's not,
sure,
you know, it doesn't get too deep into it. But one of the things that I do like is that this all, you know, made me think back to my Psych 101 and all those great terrible experiments that people did. You know, so the Stanley Milgram test.
Stanford Prison Experiment, sure.
Right. There doesn't actually seem to be a lot of concern about the ethics of what they're doing. And,
yeah,
and Charlie does bring it up.
Yeah. Yeah. That they, well, I think it's interesting too, because this is part of the plot of the family, is that they go to the sister basically and say, we want to experiment on your brother and it might make him smart. And the sister's like, great. Which I think, again, like, especially for something written in the early 60s, or I guess mid 60s, I was very impressed with how much this book is trying to say about how people view the disabled in general, and the intellectually disabled in particular. Like, it's very clear at several points about how Charlie is viewed as disposable, as unthinking and unfeeling. And Charlie, as an intelligent, you know, genius person, or even, you know, when he's not quite at his peak yet, he makes it very clear. He's like, I was always a real person. I was always a person. I always had feelings. I always had thoughts. And it's really like, who will speak for the disabled and the intellectually disabled? And the answer is Charlie gets to speak for himself. And then it leads to that moment with the bus boy. And I thought that was kind of brilliant. And one of those things is that, yeah, his sister basically was like, sure, experiment on him. Like, you did a mouse, so you might as well do, you know, this kid who has a IQ of 68. Like, go ahead. What's the harm? And he makes the point that, like, I was always a person. Like, that part really stayed with me, that he says, I was always a person. I didn't just become a person because you experimented on me.
I think the other thing that this book does well is it brushes past this. It doesn't really spend too much time on it, but it does get you to think about what exactly do we mean by intelligence.
Yeah,
because there is actually a discussion in here about IQ, which was generally accepted at the time as a completely objective measurement of people's intelligence.
Yep.
And Keyes brings up, you know, that even at this point, there are people saying, is this really a measure of intelligence? Is it a measure of something else? What's the correlation, you know,
right,
and what does it mean?
And he gets the naked intelligence first, right? And he ends up in the book, he goes to the library and he's basically reading and reading and reading and consuming. And it's an interesting point there where it's like he's primed to learn, but he hasn't learned anything. So he's got the capability to learn, but he has to learn. And in fact, in an amusing moment that I don't know, I thought it was really great, sinister, but also great. The Niemöhr and Strauss are like, sure, Charlie, learn anything except psychology. Don't read about what we do. Okay. And he's like, all right, sure. And he does that for a little while. He doesn't actually read about it. He learns about everything else. But I like that. And then, of course, as we mentioned, is the emotional intelligence, is that they have these conversations about, like, you know, he becomes essentially like has a crush on Alice, his teacher, and as he's becoming smarter. But her take, and I think it's a really reasonable one, is you're not, you know, you're just first able to have these feelings and you've directed them toward me because I'm here. But that doesn't, you're not, you have no emotional intelligence. You've never lived through this, even if you're a genius. And how many, you know, stories, how many people have we known who are incredibly intelligent and completely clueless about the emotional side of things? Like, there's all sorts of different kinds of intelligence.
There's an interesting part early on. Charlie, when he was not smart, was working at a bakery. I don't think Keyes knows anything about the way bakeries get run, because this bakery sounds like a machine shop. You know, there's a lot of guys back there,
yeah,
and they're all working machines. None of them are actually like baking. They're all like, oh, this is the dough machine, or this is,
yeah,
the whatever.
Well, like I said, it was a factory in the story, and I think that he changed it, but not as much as maybe he could have changed it. I was just reading Helene Wecker's books, The Golem and the Genie and The Hidden Palace, and there is also a sort of superhuman character who is kind of unexpectedly working at a bakery, and that I don't know whether that was whether this book was an influence or that or not, but I kept thinking about it because it is interesting that it's this, that Keyes has this down to earth kind of thing of it's just a bakery. But you're right, all the guys are like machine operators and they're kind of tough guys. They're kind of like, you know, they're tough guys.
They're like stevedores.
Yeah.
But what I was going to bring up is that one of the things that happens when he becomes intelligent is he notices that one of his co-workers, who goes by the unfortunate nickname of Gimpy, has been running a kind of a con where,
right,
he sells goods to people for less than what they would pay, but he pockets some of it. And so the two of them are sort of complicit together in this bit of, you know, petty larceny,
yeah,
or whatever you want to call it.
It's like embezzlement, basically.
It's embezzlement. It's embezzlement, but with bagels. And what's interesting is he feels this compunction to do something, but he realizes the complexity of the situation.
Right.
He realizes that he's going to come in, and if he makes an accusation, it's going to destroy a lot of relationships at that workplace. And it's going to possibly make this man's families suffer, and he doesn't know what the right thing to do ethically is. And
right.
he goes and he talks to his basically his therapist at that point, who says, like, yeah, intelligence doesn't teach you that. You got to just kind of like go with what your moral code tells you to do. And that's an interesting point to make. There is no formula. There is no calculus for
right.
what the ethics of the situation is.
Yeah, he has no right answer. He knows that there's going to be, you know, either he's going to not do anything and feel guilty because he feels so much allegiance to the guy who promised him basically a job for life. But if he tells, he's basically going to separate himself from all of these coworkers who he's known all this time and who haven't exactly been kind to him, honestly. But and you know, he does in the end say, I'm going to be honest here, but I'm going to give this guy a chance to stop it. And so the end result is that he doesn't turn him in, but the guy resents him and they get him fired. And, you know, I will throw class in here too. I feel like there is some commentary going on here about, you know, Charlie becomes basically too good for them, and it's they who reject him. Like, he's putting on airs and stuff, and they're like, we don't want you here. We want you out of here. And I guess I know they're intimidated by him and how he's changed, but I can't help but read that as also like they feel like he is not one of them anymore, and they got to get rid of him because he's not one of them or beneath them. He's now above them, and they can't take that. And then they welcome him back when he returns, right? When he's sliding down the backside again, they do welcome him back because now he's allowed in that society. And you know, meanwhile, he's also sliding into places in society where he was previously rejected, and the role that he fills in society. Like, there is one level of this book that is, you know, it's kind of like class tourism almost. It's intellectual class tourism. He is rising through levels of society because of his level of education and intellect, and then he drops back down the other side. And I thought that was kind of fascinating and handled with care. Is him being in love with his teacher at the home weird? It is. I could argue that he's hardly the same man, right? Later on, but it is still weird.
It's not at all weird that he might fall in love with his teacher.
Right.
What is weird is that she eventually goes along with it.
Yeah.
At first, you know, she seems to be doing right by him. As you say, she says, you're putting all these feelings on me because you have them for the first time, and you don't know what you're going to feel like next week when your IQ goes up even higher, and you don't know whether or not I'm really someone who will interest you. But eventually, as Charlie goes off into the world, there is quite a bit of sex in this book. I was kind of surprised by that, and some of it is disturbing. There's a point where Charlie picks up a woman at a movie theater who wants to hook up with him basically right away, and it turns out that she's pregnant, and he can't handle that, and he yells at her for being so disgusting, which is problematic.
Yes.
Eventually, he does fall in with this woman, Faye, who is, as we've said before, a beatnik, who seems to just be interested in Charlie because she finds him sexually attractive, and that's enough. And there's this weird dynamic where Alice finds out about it, and she says, I think you need someone like this who has the experience she has. Again, very mid-60s, the sexual revolution in process. So
yeah.
On the one hand, Keyes is not going to necessarily paint any of these women as morally reprehensible, but he's also going to continue to enforce certain ideas about what's proper and what's not proper.
Yeah, we also have the two Charlies thing, which is something that I also am not sure it entirely works, which is the idea that there's the new Charlie, but the old Charlie is always sort of like, he's also in his head. And the book kind of wants to make it seem like he's almost like this repressed personality inside of Smart Charlie, which I don't think it actually establishes that. I think it's a very weird like attempt of like, oh yes, and he was inside me too. But the way it comes out in the strangest way is old Charlie like is a vision or a hallucination when he's feeling sexually aroused, especially for Alice. And so that ends up being like the reason they can't do it for the longest time is like that is a level of vulnerability or something that old Charlie will not allow new Charlie to do. I don't know. I'm not sure that really worked for me. And I wonder if that is in with the Freudian analysis aspect of,
it is completely Freudian. It is all about this sort of Madonna horror complex that he has. And it, the other thing that's weird about it is when a new Charlie has visions of old Charlie, it suddenly shifts to third person.
Yeah.
And that's awkward and weird. And the I appreciate the Keys is trying to do something experimental here, but it never quite felt real to me.
So I'm going to throw something out about, well, I got two things. One is, honestly, the reason that the whole thing, the romance with Alice happens is because it's just such a great dramatic scene when he's kind of landed back at his original IQ, just shows up at her class again and sits in the back and doesn't, you know, he doesn't remember the last time he was there. But he's like just sitting there. And of course it's devastating for her because she's seen him through this whole ride. And now he doesn't understand what's wrong. He's just gone back to class. Like that's such a great twist kind of thing that I think that's the reason. I really think that he's like, oh, I got to do that. She got to get swept up in it, kind of like a melodramatic old movie kind of romance with him so that we can have that moment where he's completely back to the way he was. And she's so heartbroken. And it is a powerful moment. But I think maybe that it's so powerful that it drove some choices that are not the greatest. But the proposal I wanted to make, you mentioned the third person shift that happens occasionally. First, you know, this is epistolary. The short story was, I already said that I thought that maybe it was strained a little bit more having to do it at novel length. And as I was reading it, I thought, I get why he did it this way because the short story is this way, but I kind of think the novel might have been better as not epistolary and with some segments where Charlie is writing his journal and we can read it, but that the rest of it was in a more traditional technique. And I say that because there is the point where the book basically is like, all right, well, I've agreed to keep writing these journals, but not sending them in. And they'll read them later, maybe, but I'm going to keep writing them now. And it's very much the book saying, I know it doesn't make sense that this is still epistolary, but here we are. And I really loved this book, but I did think in the end that the notes by Charlie, written by Charlie as the entire storytelling device, I don't think it was the right call for the whole length of the book. I just think in a short story it works, and in a novel it would have been better if he didn't have to play to that concept.
I do think you're absolutely right that Keyes felt himself obligated to continue with the first person epistolary style because that was so arresting,
right?
in the short story. And one of the other things that the short story does is it's short enough and concentrated enough that you don't really care about some of the bigger plot holes or the bigger like questions.
Of course he wouldn't mention them in his notes, and it doesn't matter.
When I read it through in the novel form, one thing that bugged me that never bugged me in the short story is in the beginning of the book when Charlie is writing like he has a 68 IQ, he's writing, you know, like someone who is smart trying to imitate someone who is dumb. There are a lot of things that don't make sense. There's like all the words are misspelled, but they're misspelled in a kind of a predictable homonymic way. And then there are words that are perfectly spelled because Keyes couldn't have come up with a way to to do it. And it's all in fairly good grammar. You know, mm-hmm. It's just like it does not in any way read to me like the authentic writings of someone with a mental disability. Yeah. But when you read the short story, you're through that in like three or four pages.
Yeah.
And similarly, at the end of the book, when Charlie is suffering his relapse, you're through that in an equal amount of time. In this book, he draws it out, and it becomes tortuous. It's very, if you're not the kind of person who can deal with the characters just getting beat up on, that's like the last 20 pages of this book.
It's really, yeah. I mean, I think definitely this would work better if it had been, again, you don't need to remove Charlie's notes entirely. You can use them as portions of the book, but to have the whole book be in the notes, I do think makes it a lot harder, and he has to work a lot harder, and it doesn't all come off. I will say, you mentioned the end of this book, like, it worked on me. This was an emotional ride for me. I was moved to tears multiple times. I don't know what it is about mice. I don't know what it is about tragic animals, but his relationship with Algernon, like, okay, on one level, it's a it's this kind of bond between them as fellow patients, but Algernon is also the trailblazer. Algernon is what is Charlie's future. You know, Algernon begins having these horrible symptoms, and it's essentially the foreshadowing of how this book is going to turn. Charlie ends up figuring out what's going to happen in his fate. Algernon dies. He buries Algernon in the backyard and plants flowers on his grave. It's a very brief, super tear-jerking line in the story, but in the novel, he gets many more tears are jerked using that. And I think really effectively. And it's something about that mouse that is the genius mouse that can run any maze, and then midway through the book begins sort of flinging himself against the wall. And it's unclear whether he's having seizures or whether he's so frustrated that he knows that he's lost something. And it's that part is just sort of like, I don't know. It's a mouse. We don't really know. But Charlie knows enough to see his future coming at him. And I found all of that really effective. You talk about kind of the emotional content of this book. It's rough. It's super sad. But I thought incredibly well done.
Algernon gets a lot more characterization in this novel.
Yeah.
The way that Algernon demonstrates his intelligence is by going through increasingly complicated mazes, and they're not just complicated because they have more paths. They have other mechanisms the mouse has to figure out, and there's a point late in the story where Algernon is losing his acuity. And they describe him running down a path and suddenly stopping and basically having a breakdown.
Yeah.
You know, from a mouse's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, it's very well done. I thought it was very, very, yeah. Sad.
They try to give Algernon a lady mouse at one point. That doesn't go well. Like it's
yeah. No, there's a point, where the two professors are trying to present to a conference,
yeah,
what's going on, and
oh man,
and Charlie lets Algernon free, and to me it felt like a Disney movie at that point, like the,
yep,
the mouse loose in the,
it's a,
in the convention,
it's
center.
A little like E.T. too, where they let all of the what are they, they're mice, I think, out of the cages, be free, because they're under the influence of E.T.'s sort of empathy beam, and I actually, I wonder if that's the inspiration for that scene in E.T., honestly, is what happens here. Because, yes, it is like the world's smartest mouse is running is running amok in a crowd of scientists at a convention in Chicago. Like, and then in the end, yeah, he legs it. Charlie legs it with Algernon, right? Like, this is all kind of part of his way of escaping and also kind of screwing up the scientific presentation, because he's come to resent being the scientific example.
Well, we're getting towards the end of our discussion here. I just want to bring up a couple things that struck me. One of them is a line that I loved late in the book, when Alice is sort of circling around Charlie and they are going to reconnect, and this time they're going to do the deed. He finds her in his apartment, and he asks her what she's doing there, and she said, "I'm not here because I feel sorry for you. It's because I feel sorry for me." And Charlie says, "What's that supposed to mean?" And she says, "It doesn't mean," she shrugged, "it just is, like a poem." In high school, everyone kind of thinks that poems are puzzles to be cracked.
Right.
They aren't. They aren't. Yeah. They don't work that way. That's not the way literature works. It's, you know, it's the way maybe allegory works. It's the way that a very specific kind of literature works. But most literature is not like, now I understand and I've figured it out. So I love that line. And I just want to say, you go, Alice. The other thing that I want to point out is that at two points in the story, on the way up and the way down, Charlie is given a Rorschach test.
Ah, yes. Rorschach.
And I spent a lot of time looking up about this test. I'm one of these people who's always kind of wondered, why did anyone think these things were useful for anything? And I was shocked to find out that they are still commonly used, that there is there is a standard set that is now in the public domain of ink blots that make up the classical test, and that the way they're analyzed is not about determining, like listening when someone says, "Oh, it's a happy bunny," or someone says, "Oh, it's a man murdering a woman." They kind of don't actually pay attention to that. They pay attention to, did you hesitate when you answered? Did you use the whole ink blot to give your test? Did you give a typical answer, or did you give an atypical answer? And still, my question remains is, who correlated that with anything?
Right.
But apparently they're out there, and you can still take them. They're used quite frequently, I understand, with child psychologists.
Yes, this is the origin, in fact, of the character Rorschach from Watchmen. Is he is shown in Watchmen as being given the Rorschach tests and having horrific visions while telling the doctor what they want to hear, basically. And that is as a child, and then also as a captured adult. and then obviously it's the motivation for him and the costume that he ends up wearing. I was struck by this. I mean, Keyes is really just using it here to say, early Charlie is unable to conceive of even that ink blots could have shapes. His idea is like, he's at the level now where if he looked at clouds, he would never see anything in the clouds. And that later, he's like the rest of us, and he looks at the shapes and he sees shapes. And I think he's trying to say something about how there's a space that Charlie lives in that we don't necessarily understand, that it's a very literal, he's in a very different intellectual space, and it's a setup for him to transform. But you're right. It's, I mean, anything this old, you're going to get some fascinating, talk about 55 years old. It becomes as much a historical document as anything about like how people thought of the mind and about intellectualism and about, like you said, the dominance of Freudian thought. That's all in here. And some of that stuff is not my favorite, but they're like, in the end, I would say, I feel like it's such a mistake to take a short story and blow it up to a novel, like a short story to blow it up to a novel, because what are the chances that all the stuff that you put in to fill in the gaps is going to be good enough to make it work? And I thought this was pretty good. Like, I really enjoyed it and did not at all feel like he let me down. Not all of it was great, but the stuff that was really good, like, really made me think. It sort of did all the things that a science fiction or fantasy novel, in terms of commenting on the human condition and about how society views outsiders, and all those things are in here. And he just sort of magnified all of it. And that, I think, is maybe the greatest triumph of this novel, is that he takes a classic short story and he doesn't ruin it by expanding it. You can like it, or you can like it less. And I think that's perfectly valid to like it less, because it's never going to be as concentrated goodness as that short story. But he didn't blow it. Like, because he badly executed, this sort of like besmirches the name of the short story, and it's not that, it was really well executed, I think.
As you've mentioned, this book does get banned a lot in high schools.
It's the sex. There's sex in it, right? And so people are like, "Why there's sex?" And it's not like it's super graphic, but it's very much frank about the fact that that there are people having sex, and also dares to broach the question, like, "Well, what does it mean for the intellectually disabled man to become intelligent and does he have sexual drives, and what happens that?" And he doesn't soft pedal it. He's like, "Yeah." He's a man. He does. What's going to happen there? And, you know, yes, sakes alive, the characters have sex. Oh, no.
Any last words?
No. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to read this, because I thought I had read it and I hadn't. And then also reading the short story. And again, I'll just say I had a blast reading this. And I think if you're somebody who has been intrigued by this conversation, maybe has a vague memory of it, I think in some ways, maybe a modern reader, and this isn't always the case with 55-year-old books, I think modern readers could get a lot out of it. I think in some ways, things that were transgressive back then just feel modern and normal now. And then other things, like you pointed out with the Freudian stuff, I feel like it's so of its era that maybe some of that stuff will just slide on by you, because it's just kind of not where we are anymore. But it worked for me, and it's a treat to read something this old and have it feel this fresh. So thank you for suggesting it.
Thanks to my co-host, Jason Snell. You can hear Jason on any number of podcasts on the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join the conversation on either the Facebook page or the Incomparable membership Slack. And as always, I hope you're keeping up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.